Hello and welcome to our Philanthropy is a People Business podcast series brought to you by Catalytica Consulting and Prospectus. This is a series where we delve into vital issues for the philanthropic sector with inspirational and innovative leaders. My name is Børge Andreassen. I'm from Prospectus. We are an executive search consultancy working globally, specializing in connecting people with purpose, helping organizations find and appoint board directors, chief executives, and other leaders, and board effectiveness consultancy.
And hello, I am Sabine from Catalytica Consulting. We are a boutique consultancy that partners with foundations, corporations, and non-governmental organizations to catalyze social change. We are proud to welcome our first guests, Fabio Segura and Simon Sommer, who are co-CEOs of the Jacobs Foundation, a Zurich-based philanthropic organization with a unique focus on education. Fabio, your background is in peace building and investment. What an impressive combination. And you have been co-CEO of the Jacobs Foundation since 2019. Thank you very much for being here today with us. Simon, your background is in science management and musicology, a fascinating mix. As Fabio, you have been co-CEO of the Jacobs Foundation since 2019. Many thanks to you as well for being here with us today. Now, let's dive in into the conversation.
So our first sort of topic for conversation is really about what kind of business philanthropy is. And I think, Fabio, we've quoted you in the title that philanthropy is a people's business. Why do you say that?
Well, I think this is something that many people have said before, and including not least our founder, Klaus Jacobs, I believe. And it is very simple. I mean, if you look at the most traditional definition of philanthropy, it is love of humanity. And love, in essence, is not something that machines can do. It's not something that you have a very fixed criteria that is objective and there is an algorithm behind, but rather something where you're always encountering an ambiguous choice of doing great between various possible positive options. And only people can do that. So it's the act of people manifesting, consolidating, and expressing that love through different mechanisms to other people. And that's why philanthropy is a people's business and will remain a people's business.
And does that make it harder or easier to run almost than other businesses?
Well, you see, when you are in a people's business that is defined as love of mankind or humanity, then you do have to make very difficult choices all the time. You know, a choice between something great and something that is not great or that has a negative impact is very easy. But choosing between several different options, all which potentially can lead to very meaningful transformations, it's super tough. And therefore, in combination with it being a people's business, we need to adhere to certain, I would call it discipline of things that we commit to, processes that we make very clear and transparent, criteria we use for choices which we communicate clearly to our stakeholders and to ourselves. And so that makes it very challenging. But I think on top of that, we also are in the in a business where there are various scarce resources, not least money. But think about the management attention. Think about the knowledge that needs to be built about the solutions we create. All of that, if you do it in a very broad manner and you only engage at a very superficial level, is less likely to be transformational. So we have to be very mindful and very explicit about which areas we want to focus more on, which domains and which smaller set of choices we're going to give ourselves to become very good at and therefore develop core competencies.
And there are so many things you can do, right? There's so many needs. There's so many areas where we want to focus attention. How do you choose?
Well, you know, we look at it as a continuum of different funders that are better placed to support different initiatives and different stages of development of those initiatives. So someone like us, for example, is not very great at supporting small organizations at a sub-local level in foreign countries. Therefore, we have to be very mindful about how we select the geographies we work in and at which level do we work in those countries, because we are likely to make serious mistakes in selection of partners at that very local level in countries and contexts we don't have the expertise in. So how do we make these choices? Well, we first of all give ourselves very long-term objectives. Then those objectives are based on what we believe are a subset of competencies we can be really good at and add value that we're uniquely positioned to build. For example, being able to generate and translate scientific evidence into policymaking or into practice of different stakeholders. For example, being able to take risks, financially speaking, that unlock further capital that otherwise would have flown into education. For example, being able to innovate in partnerships by translating the interest between different stakeholders. Those are things that we have explicitly said we want to add on top of our money to our commitments. And so in sum, taking those very long-term objectives based on these core competencies and then brutally narrowing down areas where we feel we can add really more value. And in combination with that, connecting with others who add value at other stages of development or in other areas where we have chosen to be more complementary than on the lead.
And if I may jump in here, the funny thing is that it is actually easier to run a foundation badly than to run it in a professional way. And also you'll receive more positive feedback by giving a little money to one organization than to the other one and to appease everyone. But making strategic choices means saying no in 95% of all cases. And that makes it actually difficult. And it also asks for a particular kind of person working at foundation. And I guess we'll come to this a little later.
Yeah. And a feedback loop when you work in the foundation, when you have the money to give out, is obviously really interesting. And do you get the feedback when you make the bad choices and so on?
Really difficult. I believe foundations, more than any other organization, are prone to complacency. And we need people who are not too comfortable in the role of generous money distributors who need positive feedback all the time. What can you do? You can create a culture of radical transparency within the organization. The Jacobs Foundation, and we'll probably come to this a little later, has adopted a co-leadership model on all levels. So we permanently challenge each other, motivate each other, but also criticize each other. And you need to create a culture of very transparent interaction with your board, which is another thing that a lot of foundations are really bad at.
And if I might say something complementary to this is foundations in general are one of the least accountable organizational types out there. You know, we have our boards. Every foundation has a few stakeholders, individuals who make decisions behind closed doors. And then, you know, very, very few times do you ever hear somebody saying X foundation, X charitable organization did only three schools where they could have done, I don't know, a systemic change and improving the quality of education in X geography. It's very rare to hear that criticism. And so one of the things that I think are needed in our space and where we're trying to borrow from science is to publish our assumptions. Here's how we assume change happens. Here are the underlying preliminary conditions for that change to happen. And here's what we're assuming. And so our objectives are clearly put out there. And if we fail at meeting them, then we're making ourselves also accountable to a broader public that is not sitting with us in the boardroom when we make strategic decisions.
But I think the way, when I listen to you, what I hear is almost that you talk about there's like an additional responsibility of running a foundation in terms of how you act with your partners and how you see yourself. Is that right?
Well, it's not just about allocating capital, which, you know, many organizations traditionally have believed is their role as a foundation, is to allocate philanthropic capital to people around the world. It is about publishing, articulating, trying to create knowledge around theories of change. How does change occur? How do we actually modify the patterns that gave rise to the situations we're here or we exist to transform? And I think that is the more valuable legacy we can leave beyond just projects that got completed, that got some outcomes, and that got some smiley children in brochures, in glossy brochures. But it's harder to communicate, and it's harder to generate support around systemic, deeper change than it is to do project work.
You are right, Berger. Foundations are one-tier organizations, particularly here in Europe, right? So usually there is a board, and below the board there's a management, very often one person who has the entire power in the organization. I call this sometimes the last remaining, you know, fiefdoms as we had them in the past. Mm-hmm. And that asks, yes, that asks for a particular style of leadership, for a very mature way a board empowers this management, but also takes its legal responsibility. So here in Switzerland, only the board is legally responsible for the activities of the foundation. So in theory, you know, we could do whatever we want to do, even break the law, and the board would be punished for this, right? So again, this places particular demands on recruitment of the right people who deserve this trust of implementing the will of the funder, which is the only law a foundation knows. I'm exaggerating a bit, but also, you know, in permanent trustful interaction with the board of trustees.
And with that as context, what's important to you when you recruit? What are the competencies, values, attributes that are particularly high on your list in terms of the people you bring into to the foundation to work with you?
That has changed over the years. When Simon and I started, we were very keen on finding specific knowledge or experience in the areas we were recruiting for. And it oftentimes became very technical. With time, we have learned to realize that, at least in our organization, we need to be much more attentive to personality traits, attitudes, and the ability to learn, for example, being one of them, the ability to lead or share leadership. Simon just mentioned our commitment to co-leadership and sharing leadership at all levels. The ability to think through ambiguous situations and generate alignment on a way forward. And for example, the ability to entrepreneurially seek for new solutions to all challenges. Those are things that have become a lot more important, or as important sometimes as the technical aspects of managing well an organization, doing the administrative job, understanding policy or understanding financial mechanisms.
I mean, I don't want to go into MBTI characteristics here, but, you know, if you are the type of person who enjoys a lot being admired by others, you should probably not work in a foundation. So there are a few questions that you can ask that we clearly look at in order to find the people we need in our kind of organization.
Thanks so much. You've dive in immediately, right, on very deep questions and sharing your visions about foundation. Just let's go back to a very simple question so that we have it on the record. Mm-hmm. So if one of you can give us just a short portrait of the Jacobs Foundation, like an elevator pitch, what is it that Jacobs Foundation actually does?
Absolutely. The Jacobs Foundation has been founded in 1989 by Klaus Jacobs and his family with the mission to offer better opportunities to young people and future generations. So in our mission statement, it says we invest in the future of young people so that they become socially responsible and productive members of society. With the 2030 strategy pledge that we published in 2021, we actually committed 500 million Swiss francs, approximately the same in US dollars currently, to advance learning and education. And we want to do this by enabling all children to reach their full learning potential and to thrive together. And how do we do this? We foster adaptive learning ecosystems. So we support sort of larger groups of actors who are working in education to base their work on better evidence so that they can provide children with the knowledge, the skills, the attitudes and tools and equitable opportunities to reach their full learning potential. We do this across global and local contexts. We have a history of being a premier research funding organization, and our research is conducted all around the world. Whereas where we really want to make a systemic difference, we focus on particular geographic contexts. And this is currently our home country, Switzerland, two countries in West Africa, Ghana and Côte d'Ivoire, and recently added to the portfolio, Colombia, where we really want to work with the entirety of stakeholders who are interested in improving education, using evidence to improve their education system. And the foundation does this with the funding volume of about 60 million Swiss francs per year, which we get from the endowment that Klaus Jacobs has put into the foundation about 20 years ago.
So you talked a bit earlier there about sort of co-leadership models, and you are co-CEOs. And I think many CEOs I know will probably find that a bit of a difficult idea to be able to share the job. So tell us a bit about how this works in practice and how you make it work for you and for the foundation.
Well, you know, one comment before I address that question is that I think a lot of CEOs actually find it very difficult to be single CEOs. And so I do believe that in most organizations, there is some level of informal and non-explicit leadership sharing. Some of the attributes of co-leadership that we value a lot here is the way that it brings and increases diversity. So, you know, we're an organization that committed to co-leadership at all levels. And what we're seeing is that people bring different forms of diversity. For example, gender, for example, background, for example, level of experience, ability to take risks, personality traits that are complementary. So that's one of the greatest principles of co-leadership. The other principle that we value, and Simon also alluded to this earlier, is that we keep each other accountable. You would be so surprised about the amount of decisions single leaders are making that impact the entire organization, and they have very, very simple or very incomplete thought processes or motivations. So when you're fully responsible for the entire organization or for an area of it, together with somebody else, you're accountable to them as well for the outcome and for how well, what's the quality of decisions you're making. And another one, which is not minor, is the quality of life that can go with the co-leadership is invaluable. And it actually also reflects in better performance for the organization. So that's how we apply in practice. It does come at a cost. For example, we need to have very serious conflict transformation mechanisms that we adhere to in times of alignment, so that when we get there, the organization is not a lost between two different opinions. That's just an example. It does come at the cost of certain inefficiency in terms of updating two people or having to bring two people on full speed in certain decisions. And it also has a challenge in aligning individuals across the organization that have the same level of responsibility or influence over the decision. And those things ultimately do increase the quality of the outcome, but it takes some effort, and it's not just something two people do. It's something the entire organization does.
Again, to add, you know, if vanity is one of your key attributes, you're not good in a co-leadership model, right? Very often you will need to accept that somebody else has taken a decision which might not even have been yours or your preferred choice, and you need to be okay with it. So you need to define for yourself which is the threshold beyond which I am not willing to accept somebody else making a decision in my name. So we have created a very detailed matrix that we have never used, but it is there to define what kind of decisions we can take alone, what kind of decisions we have to take together, and which coordination mechanisms need to be in place. And I think it is important that you see more co-leadership models fail than work, because in a very traditional hierarchical organization, they will encounter a lot of problems. I also believe that our organization needed to mature with us. You know, now we are 2.5 years into the new organizational structure, and we believe now it has really transpired through the entire organization and has become the principle of how we run the organization.
And so practically, do you have areas of this is my area, this is my area, or and here are the overlaps? Like, practically, how does your colleagues know, like, sort of who to talk to, for example?
Exactly that. So we do have areas that are principally dealt by with by both of us. And then there are areas that we are individually responsible for. We share an office here. Most of what we do is sort of informal direct conversations. So, you know, I get an email and said, okay, have you heard of this? Let's briefly align on that. I'd say 90% of the alignment between us works in an informal way. But to the team, you need to be really clear about responsibilities. Otherwise, it doesn't work.
And the one thing that is perhaps less known is that there are decisions we are only willing to make when we can first confer with each other and align on them. So, you know, we have a very explicit matrix on what kind of things we will only decide on when together. And that's another feature that also speaks for the fact that we're both full CEOs of the organization and not half the time sharing a job, which is a different concept.
And I guess trust between the two of you must be an absolutely key and very strong feature of your relationship.
And I think it has to be reflected also on the trust between us and the team and between us and the board. If there is anything that will support co-leadership, is the trust that ultimately, even when we're very different individuals, different preferences, different backgrounds, we are fully aligned on the ethos and on the long-term objectives and our commitment to creating that change that we exist to support.
And perhaps to add one thing, you know, in the team in the beginning, people said these two guys will not make it together. Because, you know, I see people
laughing here. There were bets.
There were bets. They were giving us 3 months, 6 months. And perhaps because we were not the closest allies in the organization before, but we share one thing, and that's the radical ambition for high quality, we have been able to build this together from scratch, so to say.
And it sounds like you have a bit of fun with it as well.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Without it wouldn't work. You know, you spend too much time at work and with your colleagues to have an environment that is less than conducive also for you as an individual to have fun with it, to experiment and doing something that you're passionate about.
I mean, that's fascinating. And I think the way you talk about it, I actually think maybe many CEOs, like you said, Fabio, I would love to have a co-CEO, somebody I can share this responsibility with, because one of the things we often hear from CEOs is that sort of, it's a very lonely job, right? There's nobody else like you in the organization.
Right. I've heard a lot that I haven't got the luxury of having a co-CEO next to me.
If you take a step back to, again, thinking about the foundation as organizations, we talked about it being a people business. People often, when they think about philanthropy, about foundations, what they see is the resource, the money, and so on. Obviously, it comes with a lot of potentially direct and indirect influence in terms of your stakeholders. How does that sort of affect your leadership and the leadership required of a foundation in terms of how it engages in the world, both with your immediate partners and beyond?
One of the first things one can comment on is that not only is money and capital and financing important, given that it's a scarce resource in certain areas, not least education and education quality even more especially. But the Jacobs Foundation is one of the larger players in the space financially. And so it does come with certain expectations and it does come with certain dynamics that it creates around the expectation of capital being put either in a cause or given to a certain stakeholder. And one of the things that we've learned with the years is that for us, even though when doing a project alone would be faster, you would be in full control of the criteria and so on and so forth, doing it with others makes it just more transformational and more sustainable. And so we always tend to look for partnerships, even if we would be faster to just simply fund the entire thing on our own. It's more valuable. The quality of decision increases. Our learning from our other partners when we're sitting together and having difficult conversations just goes up tremendously, but more importantly, the impact that we create on the ground, the stakeholder involvement, the different approaches to dealing with circumstances that are beyond our control are simply more sustainable. Mm-hmm. Over and over again, we've seen that. So a direct consequence of that is our commitment to partnering and our commitment to working with others, even if we could do certain things on our own.
Yeah, and perhaps to come back to the beginning of the conversation, philanthropy as a people's business, I firmly believe there is no effective philanthropy without dedicated and smart people behind it. Even those new philanthropies these days that claim, you know, they can give out the money to organizations out there have legions of consultants behind them. But we believe philanthropy needs people in the organization that embody the spirit of the organization, that even embody the spirit and the will of the funder, because we are true to the will of our funder and we want to change the world the way he has, you know, proposed. He has actually dedicated his entire fortune to. And you need people who are willing to do this. You need to embark with you on such a journey, and you only find them if you also lead in that way. In that way, not the great hero who does this in order to get acclaim in the public, but rather a humble servant. A friend of mine once used the word humbitious, and I've added it to my repertoire. You need humbitious leaders, and that's what we try to be.
I think that's a great, great word. I think we should, maybe next year it can be the word of the year from the Webster Dictionary, humbitious, right? And what about your board? Like, what role do they play in sort of the leadership of the foundation? And again, thinking about your roles as co-chief executive.
I think our board plays a tremendously supporting role to the organization. The same way we were discussing earlier that trust is needed for co-leadership, the board has really placed their input and their contribution at the very strategic level. So if you think about these different levels of thinking, fiduciary, which is controlling, strategic, which is finding the best way to get to a known and defined objectives, and generic, which is paying attention to who in the organization frames the problems and what problems to resolve, the board has really taken a very high level role in generic thinking. And that is incredibly valuable to us because that, on one hand, allows us to really think beyond the day-to-day of operations and the management of the organization, which delegated to us. But on the other hand, because it really gives us freedom to experiment and the trust to even fail in that experimentation in a safe environment, provided and so long that this experimentation and this failing is done systemically and we can learn from it and take it forward.
And I would add here that particularly the chair of the board is important in such a situation. You know, we didn't apply for this job together. It was actually our chairwoman who asked us to take over the co-leadership of this organization. And she said, you have 2 weeks to come up with a concept. I won't accept no as an answer. We came up with a concept. So if we had this major support from her right from the start, probably, you know, the story would have been different, for sure. We try to have the entire spectrum of the activities of the foundation represented in the board. And again, here's very often is one person or two who are the experts on a topic, and we have great trust even between board members. So our chairwoman would say, okay, I'm looking at our colleague in the board who knows interventions in Africa well, and I trust on his opinion here. So the whole idea that trust is needed in a charitable foundation is also valid in the board, and that's very important to us.
Simon, you said that as a foundation, you're also somewhat bound, you said, to the spirit and will of the founder. And in the beginning, you told us that the foundation is active in several focus countries. I believe you mentioned Ghana, Cote d'Ivoire, Colombia. So very different cultures, right? So how do you adapt, you know, to such different cultures and still ensure that what you do still feels like, you know, your culture, your own legacy?
That's a fantastic question. You know, coming from research funding, I believe, and I believe there's also some research showing us that children learn, you know, in similar ways wherever they learn. So there are, you know, basic principles of learning that we as a research-based organization want to understand and want to bring to contexts that might be really different. So the funny thing, though, is that most of this research then is only implemented in high-income countries. So our choice of focus countries was based on the idea that we'll choose a high-income country, which is Switzerland, our home country, a middle-income country, which is in this case Colombia, and a lower-income country, which at that point in time was Côte d'Ivoire, so a West African country, to really see whether there are commonalities between these countries. If we want to empower organizations to adapt their programs to the individual differences of learners, which is the key target of our strategy. Can we do this in all these different contexts? What do we need to modify? But we will always be clear that we want to improve the learning opportunities for children in these countries. So and to whomever you talk in these countries, that's the great thing. They are all passionate about improving the learning opportunities of the children in their country. So we have this red thread that goes through all our target geographies. And so it's not really difficult to maintain a Jacobs culture. The Jacobs culture is using evidence, using what works to improve education systems, and not doing it based on opinions or on popular approaches, but really using the best research out there to help children learn and thrive.
And that includes our role that we have embraced as also challenging the established culture. So we're not always adapting, because the question is very loaded. It's like, how do you adapt to all these cultures? And one of the answers is we do not always adapt. There are things that are non-negotiable for us. And we see that as a sign of respect, that we consciously and diligently bring questions on the basis of evidence to the way things are done across this context, not least here in Switzerland, which is a developed country with very high income, where also education can be improved based on science and evidence.
You talked a lot there about, obviously, then your culture and some of the things that, obviously, you're clearly very passionate about what you want to achieve. How do you feel about failure? Is failure kind of in your playbook? What does that look like and feel like sometimes?
That's a tough question. Foundations in general are not good at that. And we all fail, but we don't admit it. It's not a surprise. I think we have become much better over time. We created a culture in the organization where people should try. Today, somebody asked us, I'm afraid of overstepping. And I said, we want you to overstep. If you learn from it, if you know the first overstep is always okay in this organization. Now, we are working with children. And, you don't play around with children implementing something that doesn't work, says, okay, that's a lost generation, tant pis en français. So we really want to make sure we do what we do based on evidence. If things fail, then, this might have to do with implementation. This might have to do with context. We need to continue learning. And yes, we have failed big time in the past, and we have learned from it. It is part of our culture. But every organization can become better at it, and we as well, let me put it that way.
I think the key complement to being open and willing to learn from failure is that we can always fail better and fail forward, as it has become coined in the space. Mm. One thing we borrow from science is that, in essence, experimentation will not always yield positive results. Sometimes you have the opposite effect of what you expected. And sometimes, most of the times indeed, you have no effects. Simply what you tried didn't create any difference and any change. And so that's, in our opinion, a negative result, because you have put in the effort, thinking, the money and the resources. So we have to be basically able to learn from our failures in order to fail better and to fail differently. And if we're able to elevate the knowledge that comes out of this failure and share it publicly, that requires a certain level of maturity, but also a certain level of organizational bravery, then the industry, humanity at large, will benefit from that. And those who are failing and experimenting in other areas will fail better. And that's where advancement comes from.
In many ways, failure, I guess, is a word with negative connotations, but in a sense, it is a part of success because it's part of learning. And to drive things forward, I guess you have to learn. And on that, what does success look like for you in terms of the strategy of the foundation, but also for both of you as leaders and colleagues?
Well, the first part of the question is very well captured in our theory of change for the current strategic period. And very far out there in the long-term impact, we have described how we imagine that as a result of our work, we're contributing to children that are thriving in different contexts, that we're able to disambiguate the entangled effects of different methodologies and approaches to resolving the several crises, learning crisis, systems crisis, and so on and so forth. But more importantly, I think that's something that we don't talk about enough is we have in the very far right of our theory of change, a little box that says inspiration. So we don't see ourselves as a foundation only responsible for the programs and contexts where we directly create impact. We also see ourselves responsible to capture, codify, and share everything we're learning and getting there so that others working in other contexts and with other communities and in other projects can benefit from all of that effort in a way that it just goes beyond our direct area of intervention. I would stop there. And I think closing remark on success is it would be fantastic if as a result of our work, we would increase the quality basis of decision-making in policy and practice around learning. Did that answer your second part of the question? I think, you know, as leaders of the organization, we have a commitment to those we lead. So very directly, the people in our team, should, as a result of our leadership, become better professionals. They should become more empowered thinkers. They should become more rounded and more confident and more senior professionals when they have completed their mission with Jacobs Foundation. And beyond the direct colleagues that we work with, I think communities, the same is true for the communities we interact with. As a result of our interaction, they should become less dependent on our input, less dependent on our capital, and more reliant on their own ability to use evidence to solve problems that they define for themselves and to solve for issues that they frame and that they want to tackle. And I think if we contribute to that, we've done a great job as leaders.
And if we empower two team members of this organization to follow us as co-CEOs before we reach retirement age, that would also be a success for sure.
So I would like to ask you a last question. We definitely feel what Simon called, you know, your shared radical ambition for impact and results for the future. But you are already also 2.5 years into your joint journey as co-CEOs. So is there something you would like to share with us that you're particularly proud of?
Well, there are so many things that we are very proud of. Internally, to begin with, to have adopted for the first time ever a coherent theory of change uniting all areas this foundation has historically worked on, from research and work with academics to policy work to working with the private sector. We used to have very distinctive approaches in each of our fields, and we have been able to articulate and align all internal areas of the foundation along the same theory of change. This was not minor exercise, but we were able to do that in a very compact amount of time. With that, also our ambition to create impact became more complex and became better articulated, which is around the current measurement, evaluation, and learning framework that actually makes us a learning organization. So our commitment to codifying and capturing and sharing what we're learning and what we're working on, how we're working, and why we're doing the things that we do is today a reality. And beyond that, the ambition to also lead in a very specific, let's say our ambition to lead beyond the traditional paradigms of leadership has been something that we're particularly proud of. So also transforming the way we work and we create value for each other. And externally, I would say that it is the first time that we have programs that really support each other from evidence and evidence generation and translation is the work that we do with academia to action, the work we do with practitioners and policymakers, to systems, the way we work with other stakeholders in transforming the very underlying patterns that give rise to the situations. We've given some examples in this conversation of specific programs, but it is really the legacy we're leaving behind is the trial of a very risky path for a foundation to embark on, and the ability to take all of the good, all of the bad, and all of the ugly that will come in this journey in order to give more and to leave more behind than just projects with some featured kids in a brochure.
But if there's one program that you know the listeners of this podcast should look at, I'd say they should look at CLEE, the Child Learning and Education Facility, which is the largest ever public-private partnership supporting education in Africa, where we teamed with 15 cocoa companies and the government of Côte d'Ivoire to really make a meaningful long-term systemic change to the education in this country. We believe this is the way philanthropy should go. It took us a long time, blood, sweat, and tears, but that's the program we are most proud of, for sure.
We would like to thank Fabio and Simon so much for joining us today. It's been a pleasure to talk with you both, and we've loved the conversation. It's so insightful to hear from you both. To everybody that's listened, we will be bringing you more podcasts throughout this year with fascinating, interesting people. So I hope you will tune in, and thank you so much for listening to us. Goodbye.